I'm Nick Tomlinson. I'm Deputy Director for Cat Fraud Capability in the PSFA, and I'm the chair today. I will not waffle on very much at all and get straight to the panel to do little intros for themselves. Off you go.
Oh, now we start with me. Okay, so hello everybody, I'm Nick Jennings. I work for the Shared Anti-Fraud Service. We're a partnership of councils in Hertfordshire, and we deal with all aspects of fraud, from internal fraud to external fraud, contract fraud, whatever it happens to be.
Hello, I'm Mike Brown from HMRC. I'm the head of internal investigations in HMRC. That means we deal with all of the gross misconduct investigations and probably more importantly, all of the corruption, fraud, bribery and insider threat investigations in HMRC.
Hi, I'm Rachel Tiffin. I'm Director of Public Sector and Learning at CIFAS.
Afternoon, everybody. I'm Richard Hampton. I work in the Intelligence and Fraud Prevention Units at the NHS Counter-Fraud Authority, which I think it's fair to say performs a similar function to the PSFA for the NHS and its 500 different bodies.
Super, thanks, panel. So everyone has a case study. I'm not entirely sure which order they're in. I think it's HMRC first.
I think we're going first with question one, aren't we? Which I believe, and everybody else can chip in, was how can we identify common red flags and what risk indicators do we see? So that lovely gentleman there is Mr. Mohammed Dar, who is currently at His Majesty's pleasure somewhere in the UK, I'm not entirely sure. He was prosecuted and sentenced just before Christmas 2025. And as you'll see, he was prosecuted and sentenced because he stole about £200,000 from the public purse. The financial issues that it references in that little bit is that he had a gambling habit and was addicted to drugs. He also had a debt, I think, arising from his wedding a few years back. Those financial issues weren't visible to us, but such features, such factors are a regular feature in the casework that we do. Nine times out of ten, there's usually some financial element at the back of the cases that we look at. He had a relatively junior role in HMRC, and so he didn't require national security vetting. So there was no regular aftercare questions about how he was coping financially that might have been asked in different circumstances. Probably my observation is that it's really important that we know our people and that we recognise when they're acting out of the ordinary or out of character. And that's really important that we engage with them, which I think in the current climate, in the current way in which we work, makes that increasingly challenging because, of course, many managers, certainly in HMRC and I suspect in other public sector areas represented in this room, many managers don't see their staff on occasions from week to week, or even that if they're remotely managed, as many people are around the country where we've got national organisations. So I think we often have to be thinking about a different balance between risk tolerance and business delivery. In HMRC and in the bit of the business that Mr. Dar worked for, a lot of it was about customer contact, customer delivery. Those of you not in HMRC probably read regularly about how difficult it is to contact us, how long you have to wait, etc. So from a business perspective, we're under real pressure not only to answer the phones, but also to meet the customer's needs when they come through. And I think sometimes that can result in us needing to give people lots of influence and ability to do the job, which on occasions they can turn to their own financial and illegal advantage. We need to recognise that we're all insiders, every one of us in this room. We've all got access to privileged material. And it's really important, therefore, that we should be open to having those conversations with our managers without thinking that they're snooping necessarily. You know, it's important that we also look for patterns over time rather than single red flags. So we explore effectively the appropriate scrutiny of communications data, and also have our ability to be able to access our systems, which is how Mr. Dar's criminal behaviour was surfaced in the first instance. I think we're going to talk a little bit later about digital tools, etc. But if I pass on to somebody else.
That'd be Richard, I think.
Yes. So an NHS example. I'm going to approach this slightly differently. I will mention the case itself. So we've got a senior operations manager who has effectively created two ghost employees onto the payroll. Onto the contractor list. So it was a procurement fraud as much as anything else. So he, like Mike's example, is now serving at His Majesty's pleasure, quite a successful one for us. I think he got 30 months imprisonment. But the people he was paying the money to were also convicted. They got suspended sentences, so there were two co-defendants in the case. The title of this section is How to Spot Red Flags, and I think using a case example is a really good way of addressing that rather overarching question. What allowed this to happen? So after any investigation, what are the lessons you can learn from it? What are the systemic weaknesses that allowed it to happen in the first place? They are your red flags. We may come on to it a little bit later, but I'm going to mention it now. There were adequate... this was found by auditors, but the auditors found it after the actions had been going on for something like 10 months. Every organisation will have adequate policies, but are those policies actually adhered to? Are they used? Has a fraud risk assessment been done against the policy, down to that scheme level fraud risk assessment? Have you identified the right risks? And are the controls actually being implemented? Red flags are the controls being implemented, because they self-evidently weren't.
No, this is mine.
I love the colour scheme.
This is about what data and tools that you can use to detect fraud, and sort of linking it to, and this is my case study, it's not a newspaper article, it's actually talking about data and tools that you can use to tackle fraud, and I'm really thinking about the due diligence that people have to do, thinking about the failure to prevent fraud offence and the reasonable defence that you can put in place, with the 6 points, due diligence being one of them, and the recommendation being that you use tools. And this is just an example of someone who tried to get a job 6 times, but they were CIFAS members that they tried to get the job with, and each member went into our database to check to see if the person had been filed in it for committing fraud. And every single time they applied for a job, they changed their details, their national insurance number, their date of birth, they changed their name. It was picked up and they were declined for the job. And I'm not saying that everyone should join CIFAS by any means, because there are plenty of other things out there. For example, in London, they have the Fraud Hub and they're matching on potential polygamous working. And there are other tools that you can use. But really, my point on this one was that there are tools out there that can help people prevent insiders from joining the organisation.
I can say a little bit more. I think we mustn't underestimate the power of sort of business monitoring, combining both routine systems monitoring, which we do all of the time in HMRC, but also with proportionate and necessary use of business communications monitoring. digital systems are great from the perspective of developing a good evidential trail. I'm 9 times out of 10, the cases that we develop in HMRC are established on the basis of our own business data. We can evidence who did what to which system and when. Obviously, spotting them in advance can be more of a challenge, but the same digital issues present opportunities for people to obviously understand how those systems work. I think, as was being given as an example in the NHS, you know, you can have people who are trusted, who understand how their systems work, and therefore can establish where the loopholes are, etc., more easily, and hide their activity within a sort of myriad of transactions. So processes need to be in place for good governance can also create that tension. We have to trust our staff, and we do trust our staff because the vast majority of them are honest and want to do the right thing. But the issue of using those systems to look for patterns of behaviour, for exploring what breadth of capabilities the data systems offer, are absolutely key in surfacing those fraud threats. And I think the example that you've just given is about how we clash those different sets of data can illustrate as much as anything what's going on. But it's not just about the business data. We also need to look at when people are using the systems. So what's their behaviour in terms of when they're in the office? What are they doing when they're in the office, when they're observed, as opposed to when they're not in the office and they're not observed? When are they accessing the systems? Are they accessing them in normal office hours or outside of normal office hours? Those can all be factors and things that can be captured within the data that give us an insight and an indication to the fact that something may be wrong.
Should we go to your case study, Nick?
Yeah, you can put it up. I'm not going to talk about that. I think the rest of the panel have picked up on some really important points, so I'm just going to fill in some tiny little bits from my point of view. I was really interested. I've spoken to several people about polygamous workers, and this is not all about polygamous workers, but clearly it's on the agenda, clearly it's a big risk, clearly everybody is seeing it. And those conversations today have been around when you're asked to go and investigate an allegation of polygamous working, what's the first thing the manager will say to you? And it's often performance was poor. We had red flags, we saw things going on, but we didn't do anything about it because we stretched, because they're actually a good employee, they got on well with the rest of their colleagues, so we put up with poor performance or we put up with gaps in service delivery. And I think ignoring those red flags sometimes is a problem. Everybody's under pressure. Nobody's got time to do the job and then look after a difficult member of staff as well. And I think sometimes we miss those red flags. And I'm not so hard back to what Emma said in the auditorium earlier, that, you know, you have fraudsters and you've got lazy people. Well, you know, you have lazy people, you need to manage them. You have fraudsters, you need to manage them out. You need to spot them, you need to identify them, you need to deal with them. And you shouldn't have to wait for a fraud to really rear its head before you ask for support with that. I think sometimes when you see those red flags, you need to challenge them. And again, as Emma said, just because there's red flags, it doesn't mean it's a fraudster. It could just mean they're rubbish at their job.
Can I go back to the digital piece and just...
Absolutely, go for it.
You're quite right. The amount of data that we have is huge, and are we using it all, and are we using it as indicators or flags for what we're all about, which is stopping public money being misspent or stolen? Sometimes you have to be quite innovative about the use of that data. So, for example, and I'm not blowing air trumpet, but I just found it absolutely fascinating. We're doing a study at the moment that is looking at polygamous working, working while sick. It's the sort of conclusions you can get from the analysis of the data that can give you the flags. So, for example, on those matters, and data analysis will only give you anomalies, and it's the anomalies that you need to look at and then challenge to see whether they're indicative of fraud or not. But working WASIC, using that as an example, it's looking at the highest prevalence of what sick type it is, or the people that you have got the anomalies for that identify they're working in more than one place. It's looking at which job roles are more indicative of those that are abusing the system by working while sick. It's really challenging the data rather than that empirical data, looking behind the picture and looking at the deeper picture.
Thanks, Richard. We've kind of jumped around the question list a little bit, so I'll kind of go, well, we went back from number four to number two. I'll go to number three. So how important do we think it is sort of collaborating across departments, across agencies, to share, one, to share intelligence, but two, to share best practice?
Very.
So I'll talk a little bit about this from a practical operational perspective, and I don't know, CIFAS is all about collaboration, but from a practical perspective, in HMRC we really enjoy the benefits of being a recognised law enforcement agency. So about 50% of my staff are trained to arrest and search if that's necessary. Now that won't be true of everybody. A lot of organisations will need to rely on the police to support that. But within that, and something which I think we can all perhaps invest in, is maintaining a good operational security advisor. We call them OPSIs, and I think that's the term that's used a lot around law enforcement. And that's part of a wider network of OPSIs, both within HMRC and across the UK law enforcement community. So our OPSI acts as a point of contact for other law enforcement agencies who want to share information with us, whether that's police forces or other agencies, to discuss complex operational security matters, information that may have surfaced in their investigations that may be relevant to ours. It's amazing how many times we get approached by the police to say, oh, we've just arrested somebody and a laptop or a phone has turned up with one of your members' staff's details in it, or it may even be their laptop or phone. That's really powerful. I think there's an understanding between those individuals about how they can share that information legally, how they can break it out in intelligence, that it'll be used safely and lawfully. And our ability to be able to do that means that there's then confidence, and that confidence breeds more contact, it breeds more engagement. The power of that is huge. Aside from all of these sorts of engagements with groups like the PSFA and the Joint Anti-Corruption Unit within the Home Office, we also invest in being a member of the National Policing Counter-Corruption Advisory Group that meets on a quarterly basis. It's all law enforcement agencies from around the UK, and we sit around a table and we compare notes. What are we seeing? What trends? What patterns? What are the upcoming types of risk that we're dealing with, not just from a corruption perspective, but from a conduct perspective? And you'll all have read about things that are happening in the police, etc., in that respect. And again, that creates the sorts of links that you can create with other agencies, other networks, etc., where people start talking to each other. And it's amazing what those sorts of conversations can drive.
Yeah, I think just sort of add to that, obviously it's a bit of a cliche now, fraud knows no boundaries. So, you know, we know that people who commit fraud in one sector might do it in another. And I work for an organisation, CIFAS, that is all about collaboration across sectors. We have 17 sectors, 800 plus organisations who all share data on potentially fraudulent conduct in two databases, our National Fraud Database and our Insider Threat Database. And we get one filing every minute. So, you know, that's quite considerable. It's real time. And those sectors, those 17 sectors, are sharing information constantly about frauds that are happening. And we also do to your point about sharing intelligence, we have organised fraud threat intelligence groups that have all sorts of different sectors coming along, people not from our membership, from wider than that. And one example during one of those meetings was that we found out there was someone who had 14 jobs, polygamous working, 14 jobs across local authorities and other sectors. So the importance of exchanging that information is just so important across different sectors, I'd say. Well, I think Nick might have something to say because he runs a shared service.
So we are a shared service. So that is a number of local authorities coming together to share their knowledge and expertise. But we're not selfish about that. We'll share our knowledge and expertise with anybody. So we are members of CIFAS. We've got a fraud hub within Hertfordshire, which allows us to share various data sets as often as we want to share them. We subscribe to the National Fraud Initiative, so that allows us to take part in a national exercise where we are sharing data that we hold as a local authority. Could that do more? Could that identify more risks or more potential fraud or insider threats for local authorities? Yes, it could. Could we deal with output? That's the question at the moment. We are inundated with work. So actually, I was listening to the speaker before who was talking about how you filter that data, risk assess it. I think, again, that coming back to the how we use IT and technology, I think we've got huge amounts of data at the moment. It's actually how we know what that data is telling us, understand the data, and coming back to what you were saying earlier about how we filter that out so we're finding the positive positives, not just the false positives.
I'll move on to the next question. So how do we think we can embed a culture of accountability in our organisations to prevent insider fraud? Who wants to take that one?
I'll kick off if everybody's happy, yeah. So I think this is all about creating the right environment in which our people can speak up. I spoke earlier about the importance of managers understanding their staff. But actually, in many respects, our staff understanding their colleagues can often be our most valuable insight tool. And it's not about snooping on each other, but it is about getting people to recognise that if they think there's something wrong, they should do something about it. So a bit like the classic, see it, say it, sort it. I'm not suggesting we all go out across and talk about insider risk and fraud, etc., from that perspective. But I think having that culture of feeling able to be able to talk to somebody within your organisation safely without feeling that you're telling tales is really important. So we invest in HMRC in a formal whistleblowing process, which is advertised and promoted on a regular basis. But probably more important than that, we also encourage informal discussions with a network of trusted contacts, people in each part of the business that people can go to if they're concerned or worried about something. And that's not just about insider threat. That could be about somebody's conduct, could be about their behaviour. We're in the process of refreshing our comms strategy at the moment. We want to create fresh energy in aligning with and taking opportunity of those regular events that occur within the public sector. Constantly hearing about things like Learning at Work Week. We're going to be doing a presentation on fraud and bribery and corruption in our forthcoming Learning at Work Week. There is a Speak Up Week for the public sector, which we always try and make sure that we get a slot on. And of course, there's International Fraud Awareness Week. And I suspect there are loads of others that you could tell me that we should be doing things on. But what's most important, and I constantly emphasise it, is that it's a minority of people that we're dealing with. And it's not about snooping on your colleagues. It's about considering the organisation, considering the people that you work with, and about their own safety and their security, and perhaps they need help and support.
I can't echo that last sentiment enough. The NHS employs something like 1.5 million people. It's a huge number of people. Those insider fraudsters are a tiny, tiny minority. the vast majority of people who work in the NHS are there. It's a vocation for them. They're there to care for people, and we mustn't lose sight of that. But that being said, everyone like Mr. Gandhi, who steals there's about 120 grand. The implications for that were, one, he stole money, which could be used for patient care. But the contractors that he falsely created, his co-defendants or co-accused, they were in clinical roles. Those clinical roles weren't filled while that money was being paid. Patients weren't being cared for. There's a reality about losses to fraud in the NHS that is really quite stark. I'll make one other point about embedding that culture. It has to come from the top. It has to be a statement from the senior people within any organisation that they take fraud seriously, and it's not just a tick box exercise, and they can do that by holding people to account. You know, our organisation is like very many other public sector organisations, and I just use one example. We have a policy that we have a declarations of interest policy. We have a KPI that people actually submit their declaration of interest. There's no KPI about managing what people are declaring, challenging it across procurement systems, things like that. It's actually making it work rather than ticking a box. And that's the commitment I think we need from senior management.
You go.
It's all right. All right, Rachel.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you go next.
All right, thanks. So I was sat in an audit committee on Tuesday night, because we're doing audit committees at the moment across all of our local authorities. And I was delivering their anti-fraud plan for next year. And there's a funny story about that, but I won't bore you with that one. In these anti-fraud plans that we develop for all of these councils, we always include a line about the culture, improving the culture of the organisation. And I often think, what do we mean by that? Because yes, we have policies. Yes, one of my training officers in the room right now, and she's out training people and making them aware of, you know, what their fraud risks are in their service areas and how to report fraud to us. I think she's got two roles. One is to scare them to death, and the other is to say, if you're concerned about it, tell us about it, or tell someone about it. And I think it's that. From the top, it's the message. We don't tolerate fraud. No, the vast majority of our staff are you know, proper people doing proper hard jobs. We don't suspect they're doing anything wrong. But we need to find the fraud, because that money that's lost to fraud is having an impact on everybody else that's working for that organisation, because it's less money. It's less money in the pot to pay your salaries, to deliver services to the people that we work for. So I think it's a really important message that when we're talking about fraud, we are making it clear to everybody in the organisation that they're all responsible for looking after that public money. We all work in the public sector. It's not our money, it's taxpayers' money. We've all got a duty to look after that. I think that's a really important message so that staff understand they are actually custodians of those funds. And here endeth the sermon.
Okay, I'll just be the voice of doom and gloom on all of this, really. So at SciFAS, every year we do something called a workplace trend survey, and it's due kind of probably June this year, but this year, the 2025-26 survey went out to 2,000 people, and we put a number of scenarios to them. If you came to my FTP session this morning, you'll have heard me talk about them. So we put a number of scenarios to them, and we asked them about expenses fraud, logins, all sorts of things. And I'll just read out the stats on it, because I think it shows the kind of why it's really important to kind of have a robust counter-fraud culture in place. So 24% of the people that we interviewed said that they had committed expenses fraud. 13% said they knew somebody who had sold company login details. 13% said they knew somebody who had used company funds for gambling. I'm having to read them off the sheet, by the way. And 19% of people said that they or someone else had used a fraudulent reference house to fake a CV. So if that's not bad enough, we then went to the C-suite and the business owners and put the scenarios to the same organisations. 88% of business owners said they thought some of those were justifiable, and 70% of the C-suite said they also thought it was justifiable. So, I mean, that really does show a change in culture that some of these things might be acceptable, but also I think says how important it is that you have that tone from the top and probably that all-staff fraud awareness training, because clearly there are some issues out there.
That's super interesting. It really reminds me of the rather research that Portsmouth University did into the propensity to commit fraud. Can I ask just one more slightly tangential, unprepared question? Just looking at Gandhi, and it doesn't say on the first one, but I found it really interesting talking about the non-financial impact of fraud. And it can happen in a number of ways, but it can be particularly pernicious with insider fraud. Does the panel think the current sentencing guidelines, which were developed some time ago, kind of accurately take into account that impact?
I'm more interested in the application of the proceeds of crime rather than the sentencing guidelines, frankly. I'm no criminologist, and I don't understand or probably don't have an insight into the deterrent effect of the volume of the sentence. I'm more interested in getting the money back.
I think my observation would be over the last 4 or 5 years, whatever those guidelines are, judges seem to be more willing to exercise them. It's quite interesting. You hear a lot about prisons being full, etc. But I think the attitude seems to be to treat public sector fraud, particularly, as a very, very serious matter. And whereas perhaps 5, 6 years ago we were getting a lot of suspended sentences, community service, etc., we're now in a situation where more people are being sent down for it. Well, that seems to be my experience.
Yeah, I'd say the same. We had a case in court a couple of weeks ago for a member of staff who was prosecuted and was sent to prison for 2 years. I don't know about anybody else. I wouldn't want to go to prison for a night. So, yeah, 2 years is a long time.
Super.
The only other observation is just the amount of time it takes to get things through the court process at the moment.
Fantastic. So we're pretty much at time. Thank you very much, panel. Super interesting stuff. Can everyone give them a round of applause?